This is The People's Game, KPFK Radio and Pacifica's coverage of the 2010 World Cup Soccer Tournament. Today is Sunday, June 20th, the 10th day of the tournament, and I'm Alan Minsky. Another eventful day in South Africa as the defending world champions Italy prove they're as pathetic as I've thought they were going into the tournament. Team France has imploded off the field, and Brazil has again put in a very solid performance against Ivory Coast. Well, today is Sunday, and so we have a little bit of an irregular non-Monday through Friday show here on The People's Game. I'm going to be joined by Toby Miller, who is chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside, and we're going to chat about the tournament, and we're going to talk about the media coverage of the tournament. And then we're going to be joined by Laurent Dubois, author of Soccer Empire, a book about the French World Cup team. But first, we will speak with Martin McQuillan. He is blogging on the North Korean team for The Guardian newspaper. You can find his blog at goaldifference.blogspot.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Korea's Advisor. So up next, we'll be talking with Martin McQuillan about the People's Team right here on The People's Game. Yes, the pride of the international proletariat takes to the field again in the early game tomorrow against Portugal. The glorious heroes of the DPRK. They fought valiantly, but fell 2-1 against tournament favorites Brazil in their opener. Though, I alert listeners of The People's Game to a re-edit of the match you can find on YouTube. It's done in the style of a Stalinist airbrushing of history in which the North Koreans win the match 1-0. So look for that on YouTube. But tomorrow they take to the field, and we are joined now by Martin McQuillan, who is following the North Korean side for the Guardian newspaper in London. And first question, Martin McQuillan, is are you yourself, and I ask this on behalf of the United States State Department, are you yourself a partisan of the North Korean side?
A partisan in the sense that as a football fan, I'm following the underdog, and I think North Korea are the underdog's underdog at this World Cup, but I myself, I'm not Korean or North Korean. I'm Scottish, working in London. And in the absence of a Scottish soccer team at this World Cup, I've chosen to follow North Korea.
I believe they were the tournament long shot. It was either them or New Zealand, who also, of course, had a great result in today's match against Italy, drawing against the defending world champions. But after their performance against Brazil, they have to be considered something of a formidable side. You've been following the team closely. What can you tell us about this North Korean side? Who are the standout players, and do you expect them to perform as strongly against Portugal as they did against Brazil?
I think the answer to the question, who's the outstanding player, is the center forward, Yong Tae-sei, who you may have seen in the match with Brazil weeping at the national anthem. He plays his football in Japan, but not because he has been a player in the North Korean League who has been bought by the J-League soccer teams, but rather because he's an ethnic Korean born in Japan who happens to qualify for North Korea. I think the rest of the team, you might say precisely that there aren't outstanding players. They play as a unit. They play very much according to the principles of the socialist regime, that they would be a collective who would put their efforts together to play as a team and not be concerned about the individual. I think in terms of the future games, I think they've got every chance. They've now acquitted themselves very well against Brazil. They have a great opportunity tomorrow against Portugal, who will be without several key players who have themselves performed quite badly up to now in the World Cup. And unlike Brazil, I don't think Portugal will have the flair players to break down the North Korean defence. It's also a rematch of the match in 66 when famously North Korea were 3-0 up against Eusebio's Portugal in the first 24 minutes before losing 5-3. If they could pick up a point tomorrow against Portugal, that would give them a huge boost going into the final match with Ivory Coast, where Portugal would have to beat Brazil in order to go through at that point, and it would be a very close thing between North Korea and Ivory Coast, who themselves haven't acquitted themselves very well in this World Cup either.
Though Brazil has already qualified, so it is conceivable Portugal might not face the A team from Brazil, but one imagines Brazil will want to win the group, so they probably will put out. And after all, the Brazilian B team is very strong, but that's further down the road. Now, obviously, a lot of baggage comes with North Korea. There's an incredible, first of all, it's just a throwback to so much of the language surrounding the North Korean team is a throwback to the Cold War era when it comes to talking about the athletes on the side. In fact, there was even a rumor that four players on the team had defected. Had you heard that rumor?
I'd heard that rumor, and I think that the story fell out as really a case of an administrative error where four players were just left off the team sheet by mistake, and people jumped to conclusions that four missing players meant four defections rather than straightforward clerical error. I think subsequently those four players have been reinstated on the squad sheet for the game. So I don't think anybody's has defected.
Much the same way as with the Cold War Olympic showdowns between the USSR or Eastern European countries or the People's Republic of China versus the USA or Western countries. There's a sort of a political subtext that almost isn't a subtext. It hovers over the North Korean side. What are your reflections on that? You can maybe look at it in broad terms in terms of what this says about North Korean society and maybe also in microcosm about the recent conflict between South Korea and North Korea on the high seas.
This is the whole story of North Korea at the World Cup, isn't it? This is the very interesting thing about their presence at this tournament. There's so much to say about it. Maybe talk about it internally and externally, maybe externally first. There's a temptation to say that it's a throwback to the Cold War and a lot of the rhetoric around the game and around the commentary on the North Korean team has been of that kind of order. But really, North Korea's situation in the world isn't that of the Cold War anymore. It's rather that of part of the axis of evil. This is a rogue nation at the World Cup, and North Korea politically the regime likes to think of itself as an irritant on the world stage, and that's really the place of North Korea at the moment. Certainly in the case of Brazil, if they could have produced that mighty upset against a powerful nation like Brazil. I think what's interesting about North Korea at this World Cup is the way in which the World Cup itself is this massively commercialized sporting event in the way that it has official sponsors for this and has become a totally global and commercialized event. And here you have this Stalinist state which refuses to engage with the sponsors, refuses to engage with the protocols around speaking to the media and so on. And it's just a completely different and unusual thing that we've become unaccustomed to. And I think that's one of the interesting things. Like internally, there's a lot of commentary about the way in which the regime would like to use the success of the team as a way of vindicating the regime itself. But actually, I think it's a kind of big risk for the North Korean regime, A, to open itself up to the world in this way, but also to risk the failure of the regime. And I think one of the things about North Korean football fans and North Korean population in general is that they are actually big fans of the South as well and would support South Korea before they supported anyone else as fellow Koreans. And there was a report during the opening game for South Korea, South Korea won, which fans in the North were cheering for South Korea, because of course, while it's a regime that's closed to all sorts of things, there's obviously radio transmissions and different ways of getting information into the North. So it's a very interesting situation, and certainly in terms of the usual blandness of different types of nations at the World Cup, such as Brazil and England, funded by Nike and funded by all sorts of global sponsors, North Korea stands out as something quite different.
Right. Who makes their kit? I noticed it wasn't Adidas, Puma, or Nike.
It's a very strange firm which has cornered the market in rogue state football kits, and they also make the kit for Zimbabwe, I understand, as well. So I think it'd be quite an interesting thing to track down the different nations that the kit sponsors make the kit for.
And can you purchase the North Korean jersey in London?
I think you can get most things online these days. I don't think you need to be in London to get it. But I've certainly seen it advertised in different places on the internet.
Now, what do you know about their support from South Koreans?
South Koreans, I think it would be a similar kind of situation. There'd be a lot of sympathy for the players in the North, which would be a sympathy for the team rather than for the regime as fellow Koreans.
Koreatown here in Los Angeles is, I believe, one of the largest population of Korean expats or Korean immigrants in the world, and they show the South Korean games right outside Radio Korea on Wilshire Boulevard, but of course they do not do that with the North Korean matches. It was very hard to find a large collection of people gathering for the North Korean matches. While I alerted the State Department to your cheering for North Korea, I have to confess, and this will sick, I suppose, the domestic secret police, the FBI of the United States, on me, but I can't imagine being happier about any side going deep into this tournament than I would be about the North Koreans. And part of it is that they're the underdogs. Part of it is my own lifelong commitment to ideas like socialism, even if their variant of it is highly perverted. And part of it is that they played in the first match, I thought, an incredibly beautiful style of collective soccer. Was that your impression as well?
Yeah, I recall to mind a quote from the Liverpool manager, Bill Shankly, who said that football is a form of socialism when everyone in the team plays together for the collective. It's a beautiful thing to see, and I think to see the North Koreans playing in a way that sublimated the individual to the collective, it was quite unusual to see, given the sorts of things we've seen at this World Cup so far, from, for example, the French team collapsing, arguing amongst themselves. You see the prima donnas who play for the European sides, and you've seen even amongst the African teams this sort of mentality of players on large wages playing in European leagues. This has been completely absent from North Korea, and you've had a form of football that I don't think we've seen on the world stage for quite a while.
Well, Martin McQuillan is reporting on the North Korean national team on the Guardian website, and you can actually find his reports on his blog, which is golddifference.blogspot.com, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Korea's Advisor. And Martin McQuillan is an academic who resides in London and is rooting, like myself, tomorrow for North Korea versus Portugal. Thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Day 10 of the tournament. Italy has joined the ranks of European sides that disappoint. It's quite a group. Germany, France, England, Spain, and now Italy. But perhaps the biggest news of the day is the French team, an implosion off the field just as terrible as their performance has been on the field. And to talk about it now, I'm joined by Toby Miller, chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. What's your take on the tournament so far? Any thoughts on the French side?
Well, in terms of the tournament thus far, Alan, my line is that, as unfortunately has generally been the case over the last 7 or 8 tournaments, really, the standard of attacking play has been rather poor. Certainly the very first round of matches has tended to see dominance by, to coin the phrase, well-organized defenses. We've seen what sometimes might be deemed nervous play by leading nations, sometimes could be regarded as strategically nervous play. I'm thinking of when Portugal and the Ivory Coast worked out that the best thing for them to do was to draw nil all, and did so. You could put that down to nerves, or you could say that was quite strategically smart in terms of how the points are going to play out in that group or are expected to. But we've seen an opening up and an excitement in the most recent days. I think a lot of people were hoping for better results for countries from the African continent who basically have disappointed or underachieved in terms of how they're doing. we're clearly seeing the same old in that the teams we expect to do well, Brazil, Argentina, the Netherlands, are doing well. And we've seen one or two surprise results, obviously some schadenfreude in New Zealand drawing with Italy, regarded as one of the big upsets of the tournament. But by and large, I think it's business as usual, with an underscore on the word business, because this is such a corporate event. On the French side, it's very, very interesting. What seems to have happened is that Raymond Domenech, the clearly completely embattled and utterly lunatic French manager, who claims at least that he won't select players born with certain star signs on the grounds that they won't get along with the others, and who is more interested in his marriage, or many of us are interested in our marriages, sometimes plural, than in the football team, and who has lost the respect of the side, and who, of course, has already been fired in that Laurent Blanc becomes the new manager of the French team the minute the games end. He has completely lost track of the job of keeping the side together, such that Nicolas Anelka, very successful forward for a number of European club teams and one of the leaders of the French attack, basically swore blue murder at Dominic at half-time in the game the other day and has been sent home unceremoniously, was substituted immediately and has been sent back packing on a plane. And now Patrice Evra and Franck Ribéry, who are leading members of the team, Evra is the team captain, have said that there is a traitor, they actually used that word, right, in their midst, who leaked to the press and others what Anelka said, and they're going to find this guy and basically take him out. So this is one of those wonderful stories where the happy multicultural getting along of people of Algerian and African descent playing for France over the last decade has boiled over into something quite different, not as far as we know along racial or ethnic or linguistic grounds, but along French grounds.
Yeah, it is very intriguing. And again, we'll hear Laurent Dubois talk about the French team from the perspective before the tournament, where the multicultural nature of the team in recent configurations going back through 1998 was a cause of great celebration for people who opposed the right-wing nativism of Le Pen, who, of course, loathed the 98 team that was so multicultural that won the World Cup. We'll be hearing that later in the show. Now, today's results included, again, an embarrassing draw for the world champions, a side that I root for, but I'm not unhappy with it because I feel redeemed and that Lippi, the coach of Italy, made wretched selections, in my opinion, and left off an incredible amount of offensive firepower, including Cassano and Totti, two players who are very adept at working through tight defenses very creatively, and Italy showed nothing. But again, they simply have to win their final match against Slovakia, which lost to a very solid Paraguay team earlier today. All Italy has to do is win, and they will go through. And in fact, given that Paraguay, I believe, will likely take New Zealand, it would seem Italy likely only has to draw in that match. Now, the other result from today is Ivory Coast versus Brazil. And I do want to point this out, though, about the way the tournament is going. We now have 9 matches played by teams from South America. They have won 7 and only drawn 2 and lost none. That's in marked contrast to the serious failings of major European sides, Italy, France, England, and Germany, you know, 4 of the top-ranked teams within the groups. So Europe, the teams that are sort of carrying the European banner, well, Holland stands out, of course, but the other European sides that are doing well are Switzerland and Slovenia. So, and of course, Spain, by the way, I forgot to include, so far have been very unimpressive, but they play tomorrow against Honduras. So, Toby Miller, you are an English national. Impressed with the Three Lions so far, are you?
Absolutely fantastic. I've never been prouder to have been born in Britain in my life than over the last week. No, it's clear that they are a broken team. There shouldn't be any surprise in this, in that fundamentally they're the same players that were picked in 2006 when England was completely useless, except they don't have Owen Hargreaves, a Canadian.
Who played well in 2006.
Played fantastically, right, in 2006. They're not picking Joe Cole, who could be in the team. He's in the squad God knows why he's not being selected, but who played well in 2006. And Aaron Lennon, who was very good in 06, has barely been given the ball and still, unfortunately, only crosses the ball at his own height, which is 5'5", and therefore doesn't assist the larger English players in getting it beyond the first defender. Now, England's been pitiful. What are the reasons for this? There is an argument, and you mentioned Italy a moment ago, for teams tethering, rather like a racehorse that runs through a season, and there's no point in being great at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just a sprint. It's a series of sprints, and middle distance and long distance. Will England get to the chance of building to better form? I doubt it, in the way that the Italians so often do. They did it in 82. They did it in 2006, for example. The England team has several marks against it. One is that the domestic competition is now dominated by great players from other teams, and therefore there isn't the conventional national nursery that still obtains in other wealthy leagues, such as the Bundesliga in Germany, or Serie A, or La Liga, which are international, cosmopolitan, but not nearly as much as the British game. That's one reason. A second reason is that there is a mentality amongst British coaches, and I don't just mean the managers of professional sides, but coaches of young players all the way coming up through the system, that says, not too much showboating, not too much fancy stuff. We believe in a straightforward game that isn't about careful passing and the development of skills on the part of every single player, regardless of position on the field, every player. Instead, we believe that there are certain capacities that you must have that associate with your position on the pitch. It's rather like American football, where there's the idea of specialization that's still dominant. There's no one who can play every position in American football. Nobody knows how to kick. Nobody knows how to pass. Nobody knows how to tackle, unless that's their one job. The Dutch, the Spanish, the Argentines, everyone has to be able to do everything. Well, the English have never really played like that, and I think it shows. So whenever they're up against people who operate rather differently, they're found out. And then there's another factor, and this involves speculation and guesswork on my part rather than knowledge, and that is they did play, as you mentioned to me earlier off microphone, very well in qualifying against OK teams, certainly better than the ones they've been playing so far in the World Cup. They were well orchestrated. They played some beautiful football. They scored quite a lot of goals. So there's something about the way they're coming together as a team that isn't working. Now, that can be political, it can be psychological, it can be about all kinds of other factors. We don't know because we're not inside the dressing room. But there's no doubt that players who normally are capable of passing the ball to one another across a space of, say, 5 meters, simply aren't doing that.
Right.
Now.
There were some really embarrassing straight passes there. Obviously, USA played an extremely high-profile match against England. You live in the United States. We've asked a lot of people who are clear partisans of Team USA to talk about Team USA, but as somebody who maybe doesn't root for them, what's your impression of that side?
I think they're a pretty good team. It's very difficult when you have a comparatively weak domestic league that is a feeder league. In other words, it's a feeder league like a nursery for the top competitions to sustain youth development policies effectively. And it's also complicated when you have a domestic system, if you can even call it a system, that's orchestrated around two very specific parts of the United States population, namely fairly wealthy, fairly educated, middle-class white people and fairly non-affluent Latino people. You know, they're the two basic groups that form the U.S. soccer world.
Though the team, of course, does have many players, prominent starters and otherwise, who are African-American and, of course, one Haitian-American player.
Right, absolutely. But in terms of the way in which the team is generated up from the grassroots, you've got these two grassroots groups that don't include the people that are normally part of the U.S. sports fabric. Namely, there aren't working-class white guys, by and large. It's a college sport. And there aren't that many working-class black guys. And there's not much Asian participation either at a significant level. So it's a little difficult to orchestrate in the way that hockey, basketball, baseball, football, brackets American, can be run. So that's just one thing to acknowledge. And there's also this question of the top league professionally in the country being a subordinate feeder league, which is not the case with the NHL, Major right. League Baseball, etc. Now, the team itself, I think, is really pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
They, arguably, the United States has, in the last decade, had four or five of the top, say, 10 to 15 goalkeepers in the world.
Sure.
For example, and that's an extremely important position. I think Landon Donovan is a much underrated player. He had these false starts in Germany, but he played with really big time side Everton in the English Premier League this year and was good. I'm not sure Bob Bradley's using him in the best way possible, mm-hmm. but he showed when that turned around in the second game that he's flexible as a player and can do lots of different things. I think Michael Bradley is an extremely able footballer. Mm-hmm. I think they're good in defense. They do lack a conventional target person in terms mm-hmm. of a big, bustling center forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think given that they're not the most skillful team, it probably makes sense to have that kind of person in the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may well hold them back. But they are well-drilled. They're not boring to watch. The fact that they concede goals early is great because it opens up matches. It
right.
makes the other teams think, okay, we've got the Yankees on the back foot. Let's go for gringo blood. And it means that the gringos decide, okay, gloves are off. Let's go for it, boys and girls, and see what we can manage. So I quite enjoy that aspect.
As one of the co-hosts on the show, Pablo Morales, has got a film called Gringos at the Gate about the USA-Mexico rivalry and how important it is for Mexican fans and Mexican soccer culture to defeat USA. Their next match is against the one team from the Muslim world and from the Middle East, Algeria. So getting gringo blood, one would think, would be they must know that millions and millions and millions of people across the world in that region are rooting passionately for Algeria to take the United States.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think you see that sort of anti-U.S. feeling marshaled in many, many instances.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of anyone but America, with America in this case meaning the United States.
And we're such interlopers in this sport after all, too.
Sure. Mm. But on the other hand, there are also some nice aspects to this. I went to my local sports bar recently on the west side of Los Angeles called Sports Harbor. I'm not plugging them because I don't like it there. But basically, it's what you would call a blue-collar sports guy place,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's, you know, 24/7 ESPN. It's sawdust on the floor, metaphorically, sometimes literally. Not my kind of place, kind of place where I walk in and expect not to be terribly welcome. I went in to watch Mexico's magnificent 2-0 victory the other day against the French. And there were one or two French fans who stood out because they wore clothing that's not normally allowed in Sports Harbor, i.e. clothing that cost an enormous amount of money. But fundamentally, it was a Mexican crowd. Most of the people were wearing Mexican team colors. Univision, which is providing superb television coverage, was on every monitor that was playing. And the bar staff, who were mostly Norteamericanos,
mm-hmm.
Angloparlantes, were very supportive, very happy. Those of us who were gringos in the audience or in-betweeners or whatever we might be were made extremely welcome. It was a lovely moment. And you can see those interesting occasions when the Mexican side to the United States expresses itself, you know, the fact that we're living on their territory, in inverted commas, the idea that this is not just the United States, it's something else as well, comes forth in a fairly peaceful mm-hmm. and enjoyable, quite harmonious way. Of course, there are lots of parts that are not harmonious at all. And when it comes to the Muslim world and many others who've suffered at the boot of U.S. imperialism, of course, the symbolic capacity to stand up against it is quite remarkable.
Mm. So I want to throw out one or two more football questions, and then I want to go right back to something you just touched on, which is the, again, your professional expertise and your analysis of the television coverage and the media coverage in general, and in the United States and, if you like, also across the world. But just two more quick football questions is your take on the Mexican side. Lastly, Brazil, Argentina, and Holland right now seem the strongest sides. I thought Paraguay was quite impressive today, and I think Chile could show something again tomorrow. They play Switzerland in what's a very important match tomorrow. So Mexico and then teams you like so far.
I've loved the Mexican team in the two matches it's played. I thought the game against South Africa that started the tournament was one of the best I've seen in a long, long time in the World Cup. I think it set the stage for some of the better other games that we've seen. I thought the South Africans were terrific. I thought the Mexicans were terrific. Mexico, unlike, say, England, is full of skillful players. It's full of running. And one of the things that is great about it is that when it went behind to South Africa and the heads dropped, as heads often do when you go behind in sports, the heads came back up again about 10 minutes later, and they were really up for it. Against the French, a very famous team that, of course, has won the World Cup, that made it to the finals last time, that has astonishingly gifted players for it. The Mexicans just bossed the game. I mean, they dominated it. To see Cuauhtémoc Blanco come on and score that penalty, and, you know, all the dudes in my local bar shouting, Perito, Perito, as he goes up to take the kick, and to realize that you can have somebody who's outside the general commodity form of football. You know, he's a little tub. In England, when Cuauhtémoc Blanco came onto the field, we'd be saying, who ate all the pies? Who ate all the pies? He doesn't have the physical body shape that you're supposed to have as an international football player. But, of course, he's got skill, and he's got intellect, and he's got passion. And he arouses all those things in his colleagues. So seeing that fills me with a lot of hope. Do they have guys when big Europeans or Argentines or Brazilians crunch them to be able to take it on? Will they be able to deal with the long ball, with big, competent center forwards? That's going to be a question as we move on. I'd love to see Mexico go a long way in the tournament. They've always been one of my favorite sides.
Yeah, it'll be something else here in Southern California if they do. Just quickly again, Argentina, Brazil, Holland, anyone else, or which of those three sides you think looks strongest?
I think all those teams look very strong. There is always this anxiety that if you start too well, can you actually keep it going for seven games in a row, which is roughly what's required. Maradona, lest it be forgot, the Argentine manager, picked, I think, 105 players in qualifying, something like that.
Sure.
Very inconsistent. It's not. He hasn't yet faced a major tactical challenge. Are Maradona and his coaching team up to dealing with what happens when you're up against really sophisticated opposition and very smart management? We don't know, but they've been stunning so far, wonderful to watch. Brazil, you know, Dunga is a Tayloristic kind of scientific management Fordist guy. He could be running a factory in Dearborn in the 1940s or 50s. He's a very able manager. The Brazilians still have great players that have show wonderful individual and collective skill, but they're extremely disciplined, well orchestrated, and so on. They're looking very, very good indeed. The Dutch, in a sense, everyone's second favorite team, great innovators. They really brought the concept of total football, where every player can play in every position, to the World Cup in the 70s. Twice they lost in the final of the World Cup. They've never won. They're very entertaining. They haven't played all that well so far, but they haven't been threatened, and they've won easily. Spain, well, appalling against Switzerland. They were dreadful. Can such a wonderfully gifted group of players be that bad again?
Here's my take on them. I think they could very well bounce back, and they are wonderfully gifted. They're a very positive side, and they've been on top of the international soccer world for quite a while. As a partisan of Italy, I know how frustrating when Italy has a strong side, not this year, it is to face up against the Italians, because they can win when they absorb you, right? Mm-hmm. Spain is all positive. They're like a hyper-positive side. Their defense is the fact they control the ball. They don't have a long-range shot, okay? So teams can really pack it in against them. And I think that's what Switzerland did. And they got hit on the counterattack. It was clumsy, but they got a goal. And we'll see how they bounce back. But And not to make too much of one performance, certainly this is a side that does have the strength as well in the back line, that facing the top teams, they can certainly bounce back and play with anybody. But I think this is the vulnerability of a team that is so positive that, you know, brain trust of a team that's compact and well-organized, they can maybe stifle them.
Right. And I think the one thing that would work for Spain against that is a fit, and not only fit, but match-ready Fernando Torres. Because he is tall enough and actually strong enough,
despite his
build. Mm-hmm. You know, El Nino has the capacity to take a lot of physical pressure. He can win the long ball. He can also shoot from reasonable distance. And he can certainly score a goal in a counterattack. The problem is he fit, and is he match fit?
Well, it'll be interesting for Honduras to see what they can do tomorrow, because they, I don't think that they have the experience of playing the kind of compact professional defense that Switzerland threw out at them. They have a lot of skill, though, Honduras, and Wilson Palacios is one of the great holding midfielders in the world right now.
Palacios is terrific. One other team I'd like to mention we haven't talked about is Portugal. We still don't know exactly how and why they played so poorly against Ivory Coast, other than maybe, as I said, they could see the value in drawing with Ivory Coast, given that Brazil is expected to go through from that group and only one other team can. Cristiano Ronaldo is a very great footballer.
Sure he is.
And they have plenty of other very able guys there. Whether it's enough to take them through, I don't know. But we'll see. They have the capacity to go further in the tournament.
Well, they sure do. But they lost significant players, one from Man U, one from Real Madrid, and one from Chelsea. And to lose top-line players, because they lost Nani, he certainly, I felt, was going to be the primary creative partner of Cristiano Ronaldo on this team. He plays for Manchester United. Pepe, from the back line, is a very powerful and strong player, mm-hmm. absolutely in his prime, unavailable from Real Madrid. And people forget, but Bosingua would have provided them a lot of offense down the right wing from Chelsea. He's been gone for ages for Chelsea. But that's three starters off the team, and not many sides could absorb that kind of loss.
That's true. And they're not picking Shimao at the moment, mm-hmm. which is strange to me because mm-hmm. I think actually, especially in the absence of Nani, they mm-hmm. need attacking forces so that Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't have to do everything.
Well, let's shift gears now. And Toby Miller is chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's the author of a number of books. The most recent one is Television Studies, The Basics. Wrote a book called Sports Sex, wrote a book called Global Hollywood, Technologies of Truth, Cultural Citizenship, and the Popular Media. Nothing is more the popular media than World Cup broadcasts. They are the most popular media in the world. So first of all, let's look at this in the United States and maybe the English language coverage in the United States. Your thoughts on it?
Well, what have I tried? What have I sampled in terms of coverage? I guess nowadays we have to talk about blogs as part of coverage mm-hmm. because frequently nowadays when the mainstream bourgeois media want an opinion on something, they don't go to another journalist with a magazine or an academic, God forbid. They go to a prominent blogger. So it's been interesting to see the rise of so many good blogs. One of your co-hosts, Jennifer Doyle, mm-hmm. Is a terrific blogger on football, for example. It's been interesting to listen to ESPN Radio, which I've done a bit of, because ESPN Radio, particularly here in LA, has been full in the past week of the fakers and the fakers' attempt successfully to win the NBA championship. Mm. And so in build-ups to games, for example, in the build-up to the USA-England game last weekend, the commentators or the Lynch guys in the studio are saying things like, well, I don't know much about soccer, but, you know, each time the World Cup's on, I really want the US to win. Mm. So you get that kind of attitude, but it's not actually condescending or critical of football and its fans. It's just saying, this isn't my thing, but I respect it. And I've quite enjoyed that.
Well, that came from on high. They've invested a ton of money in their...
Oh, you cynic, but I quite agree.
Yeah.
Of course, ESPN is owned by Disney, which owns ABC. ESPN, interestingly, for its commentary on television, has basically hired, for the play-by-play, British commentators.
Right.
So it's consigned a number of its regular guys who work for it in Bristol, Connecticut, to doing radio stuff or to being very much background people. So it's gone for the Anglo voice as the dominant play-by-play voice. It's had some U.S. guys commenting as the color commentators, so-called, or the expert former player, or in the studio. It's had a couple of people from Europe, from Spain, from the Netherlands, from Germany. It hasn't made extensive use of any women commentators mm-hmm. that I've noticed.
Yeah, Julie Fowley has dropped way into the background.
In terms of the dedicated football channels, so Fox Soccer Channel and Fox Soccer Plus, they've brought in, again, heavy hitters from Britain. Instead of bringing down Bobby McMahon, the Scottish guy from Canada, who, along with Julie Fowdy and others, was involved in either ESPN or Fox soccer coverage last time, they've got Richard Keys, who is a Murdoch employee from his Sky television system in the UK, fronting their post-match games. They've got Andy Gray, former Scottish international player, who's been brought over from Britain. They've got Christopher Sullivan, former US team player, and they've got Warren Barton, who was briefly an English international and is now a coach in the LA Galaxy system in Major League Soccer. So there is this notion still that the English voice, particularly the English voice of masculinity, is the one that tells you what's really happening.
Mm-hmm.
So all the US commentators, JP Delacamera and others, are not quite up to it in the eyes of the Disney apparatchiks, which is interesting in itself. And as I say, women have been very much marginalized. We also haven't seen Latin American-based or Latino commentators on Anglo TV.
Now, do you think that these British announcers have been asked to be a little remedial? I feel that they have been.
I think that's absolutely right. They're explaining terms in ways that you wouldn't normally get. They're doing that on the fly in the play-by-play commentary, mm-hmm. and they're doing that in the special comment section. So one of the tasks of Richard Keys, who is fronting, who is anchor person for the Fox Soccer Channel, Fox Soccer Plus mm-hmm. post-game coverage, is interrupting the experts and saying, can we just bring that back? Can you explain that term mm-hmm. for a moment? And I think it's been done reasonably well. Because
mm-hmm. That's my sense too.
You know, when I watch the Olympics, there are lots of sports about which I know very little.
Right.
I like not massive condescension, but nor do I like the feeling of being frozen out because I can't quite get it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Moving off of television then, the coverage, English language coverage, obviously the main thing is there's been so much of it here. What do you make of that and what do you make of the coverage?
Well, more tickets have been sold to World Cup games in South Africa to U.S. residents than any other country.
Though we have speculated here that that is because there are so many also Mexican fans that are actually there from the United States. So it's both supporting Team USA, some global soccer fans just going there as soccer tourists, and maybe in general for the tournament, because we do have a lot of sort of ecumenical soccer fans here in the United States, and then a lot of Mexican Americans too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It doesn't go against the fact, though.
Yes, that's true.
So I think that, plus the fact that there are now so many people so interested in football, plus the fact that, you know, if you go to some of the proprietary marketing databases, which are hard to get at because you've got to pay, you know, $2,000-$4,000 in order to gain access to them and to their reports that professional merchandisers are putting together, or you look at some of the stuff that's put out that's freely available to people like you and me, you see that there's a very keen marketing effort underway and has been for some time to dispel the notion that Americans, meaning gringos, don't like soccer, meaning football. Because there are so many of us living in this country and happily living here, both who grew up here and who didn't, who love football and are interested and who, yes, have money to spend. And some of us don't have much money to spend. So I think the fact that the football fan has not been the traditional target point of the newspaper, radio, television marketer is changing quite quickly. It's being supplanted by a realization that there's a lot more interest than was acknowledged before by the very tightly circumscribed Anglo-male world of conventional sports coverage. Plus, the time zones work quite well. You know, the 2002 World Cup, which was in Japan and South Korea, worked very poorly in terms of a lot of people being able to watch and being able to read the papers and get what's going on. This time zones work reasonably well, particularly in the East Coast and in the central part of the country. And I think newspapers in particular are realizing that their newsprint days are ending, perhaps not around this corner, but some point at the end of the next freeway exit.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more and more interested in very quick, very snappy coverage that's well suited to dealing with overnight or early morning sports coverage. And they're very interested in feature stories. And a feature story that keeps playing again and again in papers, in blogs, in magazines, and in the other electronic media is, do Americans like soccer?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that expression is being used over and over again. And we're seeing a fascination on this. The left, reasonably silent on the topic. The right, hysterical, histrionic, crazed. Because for the right-wing media, I don't mean the conventional bourgeois media, but the real crazies.
Right.
For the right-wing media, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the people around the Fox properties, outside the Fox soccer properties, of course. For those crazies.
Mr. Murdoch hedging his bets.
Absolutely, as ever.
Big
Rupert, the dirty digger, as he's known in Britain. For those people, this is a symbol of internationalism, So it's the same problem that the Supreme Court majority judges have with international law. It's a symbol of immigration. So it's the same problem that a running scared, monolingual, relatively monocultural worldview has
right.
with immigration. And of course, more than anything, it's the sense of guilt and anger about the relationship with Mexico and Central and South America that pervades so much of Anglo discourse in this country.
It's cutting into American exceptionalism.
Right.
And the you know, the myth of the strong white male individualist Texan American with his gun is that we are the exceptional people of the world. Now all of a sudden all these people from inside the country are attracted to the this source of tremendous joy for all the peoples of the world.
Yep. So if you go back to Jack Kemp, who was, of course, a vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party, a member of Congress, a key figure in the Reagan administration. Very famously, Jack Kemp, who was also a professional football player
right.
in football
right.
in the American football sense, famously saying that soccer is un-American because it's European and socialist. It involves collectivist identification and so on. You see similar meretricious remarks being made today by G. Gordon Liddy, by Glenn
right.
Beck. You know, and we can fixate on those notions of American exceptionalism, worry about them too much, I think, on those of us who are more progressive. But they represent an ongoing strand in the mythology of empire that needs to be punctured whenever possible.
Certainly American football, if you're the quarterback, of course, is much more hierarchical, and the position of the quarterback is sort of the on-field CEO. Kemp, of course, was a quarterback, an accomplished quarterback.
And not only that, but the key difference between association football or soccer and most U.S. sports is that it has a lot of continuity, and with continuity comes a relative amount of autonomy for the players. The manager can't simply shut down the production line and say, the new target is this, the new quota is that, you're going to do this, that, and the other for the next 20-second play. It doesn't work like that. So you can't have a Phil Jackson or a Bear Bryant instructing people every 13 seconds. Not going to happen like in basketball and NFL.
Spanish language coverage quickly. You had commented on early and any reflections there and how you see that fitting into the American media scape.
In terms of Univision, important to remember as background that in about, I think, 17 out of 52 weeks of TV ratings last year, Univision won. It's more popular than NBC, more popular than CBS, more popular than ABC. The idea that HBO is an important network is laughable next to Univision. It is again and again a ratings leader. This is something that most people don't want to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the most popular network we have. Technologically, I've felt that its coverage has been way in advance of Disney's ABC ESPN coverage, in that obviously it's in HD, just as ESPN and ABC offer to those of us who are lucky enough to have high-definition television. But in addition, it's got much more sophisticated ways of slowing down the play, explaining the play, using computer graphics and simulations to account for how things happen and how things are likely to happen. And aligned with that, its level of address, the way it's talking to us, doesn't have to engage in a lot of education.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, as we said earlier to ESPN and ABC, they feel rightly as though they need to bring some of the audience along. Univision doesn't. So it can assume that people know about the players at some level, at least for a number of the leading teams, certainly the Mexican national side, and therefore is able to get more technical, but always in the same good-humored, bantering way that you know, in quite reasonable fashion, get on the Anglo broadcasts.
Okay, now I want to even broaden this out even a little bit larger. Beginning in 2007 and then hitting hard in the fall of 2008, as everybody knows who's listening, everybody in the world knows there was this huge crisis within global capitalism, okay? The World Cup soccer tournament is the most popular cultural event in the world. I've been saying consistently the only thing that really rivals it in terms of human minds paying attention to something is actually a general U.S. presidential election. That goes on for about the course of a year. This is 1 month concentrated. Okay, so how do you see this tournament playing out against that backdrop, and in particular, the global media coverage playing out against that backdrop?
Well, at a micro level, there are immediate economic impacts on different industries caused by the World Cup. So, for example, the month of the World Cup includes 4th of July, which is a tent-poling date, to use the cliche, of course, for the release of blockbusters here in the United States by the Hollywood industry. Now, increasingly, in order to avoid so-called piracy or borrowing, as one might call it, by not only people based in the US but other countries too, the strategy has been to have big movies released simultaneously right around the world rather than with a delay between the US and elsewhere. The problem is, especially outside the US, nobody goes to the cinema between June the 11th and July the 12th, or whichever one it is, 2010. It's always the worst month for Hollywood. So Hollywood plans its international releases completely differently every fourth year from the other three. So that's an interesting kind of micro element. It also has a big impact on media providers, television networks especially, who don't have the World Cup. So to take Fox Soccer Channel and Fox Soccer Plus, Fox doesn't have World Cup screening rights here. They are not even showing highlights of the games when they discuss them. Right. They're only showing still graphics.
Right.
Normally, they have a very busy, very successful phone-in system where people from all over the country call in to talk about football. That's not happening this time, even though they've got very talented people. So at a micro level, you can see an impact on connected culture industries. It's quite dramatic. At the macro level, it's long been said that sport is recession-proof. That the addiction, the fetish, the love, whether it's for nation or self or ethnicity or sport, whatever you call it, is so great. The cathexis, the process of placing your love onto something so all-enduring, so omniscient, that even when times are tough economically, people who have any disposable income whatsoever will spend it on something like the World Cup. So that's, I guess, a big issue, and we're certainly seeing that happening. There is also great controversy over, getting to the political economic elements, over the expenditure of public and private money in South Africa mm-hmm. for the creation of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We have these fancy stadia, which are being justified by the South African government on the basis of the multiplier effect notion, i.e. if you spend government money, that has a spill-on effect, in that the people on whom it's spent spend their own money, and therefore you get more private investment. There's that argument. And then there's the hoary old chestnut that says this infrastructure that we're creating in terms of hotels and swimming pools and especially football stadia will become available to everybody else afterwards, and therefore it's an ongoing public good. Well, that's been used spuriously to justify mad public investment in NFL, NHL, MLB grounds that are used for virtually nothing else here in the United States, incredible waste of public money but subsidized billionaires. It's been used madly to justify lunatic subvention through public funds of sports stadia for the Olympics all over the world.
Which is part of the background to the Greek debt crisis.
The only instance that anyone can find where it really works, the most notorious, of course, being Montreal, the 76 Olympics,
right.
is Barcelona in 92. And that was because Barcelona, with Spain coming to the European Union, getting a lot of subsidy, suddenly became a favored convention center for all kinds of international congresses, particularly European-based. Everybody flocked to the place and used the facilities right after the 92 Olympics, and they got a return on investment. But fundamentally, that argument is probably spurious. So you're seeing a drain on the South African economy for a very dubious activity. You're also seeing, of course, an interesting moment potentially in the overheating of the sports media market.
Mm-hmm.
What do I mean by that? Well, you may have noticed that Monday Night Football, a staple of television here in the United States on broadcast for 30 years, isn't on broadcast television anymore.
Right.
It doesn't rate well enough. It's gone on to cable. And that's just one little sign of the way in which the billions of dollars invested in the culture industries, and especially in sports television by media moguls, may well be turning out to be ill-invested. Before the 2006 World Cup, we saw the German rights holders go bankrupt, for example, because of the vast amount of money expended on obtaining the rights. So the idea that this is recession-proof and that the sports market can just expand and expand and expand limitlessly is really being brought into question. We're seeing more and more clubs go bankrupt. In the lower divisions in Spain, there are professional players who haven't received a pay packet for 12 months.
In the Premiership for a few weeks with Portsmouth this year.
Absolutely. In the English Premier League, we're seeing teams go bankrupt for the first time, with Portsmouth going into receivership and the sacking of many proletarian workers within the club and even the elite aristocrats of labour, namely the players, not getting their full remuneration for quite long periods. So I think that people, are investment bankers, media moguls and so on, are having to rethink exactly what sport means in the context of the recession.
Even widening the lens further, and you can just bat this back to me and say you maybe don't have anything to add on it, but do you feel that this tournament taking place as it does now, and everybody, there's no reason anybody would have thought this would have been anything except more popular than the World Cup 4 years ago. Is the one 4 years from now be more popular than this one? Soccer is hugely popular across the globe. How do you think that this plays into the general world population's sentiment about contemporary global capitalism? Is it proof of it gives to the people what they want? Does it not impact that at all in your estimation? Is it an effective opiate, or is it actually something that can bring people together and be utilized as an instrument for greater social solidarity?
One of the biggest problems with sport in general mm-hmm. is that it fits a key mythology of neoclassical economics and of so-called laissez-faire capitalism, namely that, and think about all the metaphors, a level playing field being the classic. If you put the best up against the second best, then the best always wins. That competition generates both collaboration and also triumph. That it's about fairness, that you get what you deserve, that what you put in you get back. That natural talent's terribly important, but so is obedience to and subservience to management. All these shibboleths that inform both the very individualistic model of capitalism and the obedience model of the factory worker who must behave absolutely and blindly. Both those models of capitalism are given great metaphoric embrace by sport, and especially team sport, because you see both individual brilliance and subordination to the collective good in a competitive frame.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real problem in the metaphoric smugness and neatness of the relationship between capitalism and sport. Now, that said, anybody who has a long, powerful connection to place and team quickly learns how brutal capitalism is.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have the commodification of a team, as we've learned here in the United States, where we really set the standard, suddenly your team's no longer there. I mean, why are the Dodgers and the Giants in Los Angeles and San Francisco? Why aren't they in Brooklyn? They're not in Brooklyn because of a combination of corruption, of public incentives, and because of technological breakthroughs and new media markets that brought them out to California in the post-war period. Why is there a team called the Lakers in the middle of a desert called California?
Minneapolis, yeah.
Right, because they were, in fact, a Minneapolis-Minnesotan team. Now, those little residues leave real scars on the part of people who remember. Why does Spike Lee always wear, you know, a baseball cap from a team that hasn't been in his barrio since he was 6 months old?
Mm-hmm.
So people remember that, and they realize there's a real price to be paid often. So I think there's a way in which one can turn around this neat, nice metaphorical relationship between capitalism and sport and reconsider it. And to give one quick example from baseball, the way baseball has tried to deal with the overheating of the domestic U.S. sports media market has been that in order to counter that, and specifically to counter successful union and legal action by players to make for free agency and higher salaries, it's used the first world as a place to try to breed more spectators. So
mm-hmm.
they love having MLB games in Japan. And the third world as a place to breed cheap players who don't have the amateur draft protection and the college experience and managerial support that they do here. Hence the fact that a quarter of the players in the majors come from places like the Dominican Republic. It's not that Dominicans are so great at baseball. It's that we've set up nurseries there where people are signed on at the age of 11
mm-hmm.
with no guarantees of any future education or anything else of any high value, on the off chance that they'll be good enough to make it to the majors and not cost very much. Now, again, that can lead to extremely interesting experiences and encounters with capitalism and great criticisms of it by those who don't make it through the system and realize this isn't about individual opportunity, nor is it about real collective solidarity. It's about the brutal exploitation of public and private resources mm-hmm. by millionaires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you certainly have that too in global soccer, as you see with the African players who are superstars for the top clubs in the world, and yet their national sides have no comparable infrastructure. They get these coaches who sign on to the teams who are basically six-month mercenaries, so the teams come into the tournament, have no cohesion, and then they lose even though they have tremendous stars on the side.
Well, take Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire,
right,
where Sven-Göran Eriksson, Swedish, very successful manager, did manage England to two abysmal campaigns in the World Cup.
Not as abysmal as this
one. Not as abysmal as this one, but still very disappointing. A kind of disgraced coach, a person who will do anything for money, as has been shown.
He made a mess of Mexico recently.
Right. Made a mess of Mexico. They nearly didn't qualify.
Right.
6 days work with the team before they came here. $2 million he's being paid by Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast. Didn't know the names of many of the players. And the players themselves, they're a wonderful team. They come to the World Cup with their bodies torn, broken, mutilated by being put on the wheel of European football for month after month after month, barely able to play at top level for their team. Same story as generations of Kenyan, Ugandan, other East African runners who go to the U.S., participate in college track and field. When it comes time for the Olympics, they can barely walk.
Obviously, professionally, you're somebody who looks at media in all of its nuance. And some people might consider that a fun job. It's a very difficult job, I imagine, but because it's a very complex thing to often to get a grip on. But, you know, sort of the Guy Debordian critique of the society of the spectacle. To me, and this is a big issue for me because, you know, putting this show on, you know, the people's game, soccer from a left perspective, I love the sport. And I think it's a bit of an easy fit in the United States because of what we talked about with the tournament being a rejoinder to nativism, entry into an internationalism, and, of course, American nationalism is such a toxic force around the world. And here's this one thing that, you know, Glenn Beck thinks is socialist, right? So it's sort of easy to embrace. But from an internationalist perspective, the World Cup, is there a way that this whole spectacle experience can, in a sense, right, put on by corporate money, right, put on by the big moneyed interests from around the world, can, in a sense, be kidnapped by the left? Do you see any route to that?
Well, one of the things that the left needs to do better, and of course that verbal formulation is one we're all too used to, mm-hmm. one of the things we need to do better is theorize and participate in pleasure, in joy,
sure.
in fun.
Absolutely.
Right? This is a big thing for the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big thing for leftists more generally that, you know, we have more fun. We have better sex.
Mm-hmm.
We're nicer. We kill fewer people. We've got to emphasize this.
And we want everybody to be prosperous and have as much liberty as possible. These things never break through.
Right.
And
don't.
Soccer is a joy.
Right.
And we're happy to have high-tech cameras deliver this to people so they can watch the best practitioners of the sport around the world.
Right. So we've got to be very careful about being killjoys.
Sure.
At the same time as we have to be realistic and we don't want to be Pollyannas, if I can take those
sure.
antinomies, those opposites. And I think that sport is an area where people can learn about the value of solidarity,
mm-hmm.
Of togetherness, of difference, and see it operating. It can be a leftist utopia as much as a capitalist utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been plenty of football players through the years, as there have been plenty of sports people in all kinds of endeavors who are progressive. And in particular, we see the possibility of a multiracial utopia emerging, of people being able to get along, play together, work together, and find a new means of defining what it means to be French. Or defining what it means to be American in double inverted commas.
Right. I've been trying to draft something and work out the details, but coming up with these sort of simple snap points, one of which, I mean, this is very petty, but follow me here for a second. Playing soccer, playing it, and watching the greatest practitioners in the world, both women and men, play it in high spectacle events like World Cup tournaments, more fun than constant economic anxiety. Right. Everybody can agree with that. Right. So, you know, having a middle class life so that they don't have to worry about where their next paycheck is or their debt load and how they're going to afford their house payments. Soccer more fun than economic anxiety. Soccer is so beautiful and so fun. Second point, that worth not despoiling the earth because we won't have the fun of playing soccer and watching soccer. So I'm working on these things. It's a work in progress. But, you know, well, basic bullet points, you know.
Well, you know the old expression about football, about soccer, which is it's a game for gentlemen played by ruffians.
Uh-huh.
And that's, if you like, a very interesting take on the cliche, the beautiful game. Because when you say it's a game for gentlemen played by ruffians, what you mean, and the you in this sentence, in this phrase, in this paragraph, is, you know, a ruling class English person, right, who's saying this. What you're saying is, here is an example where something that is regarded as artistic, aesthetic, gorgeous, and sublime, it runs the gamut of philosophical aesthetics, is something that is dominated by people who are from proletarian sections of the world community in terms of the playing.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there are many instances, and the World Cup's one of them, where increasingly spectatorship at the grounds is reserved either for the wealthy or for those who've really made a huge monetary sacrifice to watch, and even though it's clear that there is a labor aristocracy that is playing the game, and even though it's run by a bunch of good old boys who, most of them, with the exception of people like Michel Platini, who runs UEFA, the European magisters of the sport, were never very good, even though all of that's true, it's still the case that you're getting a thing that people appreciate for beauty being done by working people, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in the symbolism of that, in the snobbish sentiment of a game for gentlemen played by ruffians, that, again, we can do something with.
Well, I've been speaking with Toby Miller. He is a professor at the University of California, Riverside, in the Department of Media and Cultural Studies. His most recent book is Television Studies, The Basics. And actually, we're going to have just a couple more minutes of Toby Miller, because earlier on this show's home station, KPFK, Toby spoke with one of the hosts, Ian Masters, and myself, about the refereeing at the World Cup and whether there's ways to improve it through technology, since there have, of course, as there always seems to be in major soccer tournaments, some very controversial refereeing calls. So we're going to hear that. And after that, we're going to be right back in this extended weekend installment of the People's Game to hear an earlier interview done with Jennifer Doyle and myself, talking with Laurent Dubois, a professor at Duke University who had a course this past year on the World Cup and world politics. His new book is Soccer Empire, about the French national team in the context of French society and French politics. So now, more of Toby Miller on The People's Game.
Since you've done so many books on the globalization of sports and sports sex, one can't help not talking about the World Cup that's ongoing. And one of the things that I think is extraordinary about this World Cup is that so many of these critical games have been decided by the officials, not by the players. And that just seems ridiculous.
Well, it's one of the interesting complexities of the game. In many ways, it's been in the forefront of new forms of governance, new forms of corporatization, and so on. But when it's come down to new technology, the game is still mired in a very subjective model of officiating that really has been in place for well over a century. It's only a matter of weeks ago that FIFA, which is the French acronym for the international body but runs what I'll call football, but most of our listeners will probably think of as soccer, decided apparently fairly definitively, that it's not going to bring in new technology in order to do things like have replays of crucial decisions. It would be useful, some would argue, for the referee to have not only the lines people who are on the field, but somebody as an eye in the sky, you know, up in a box, watching replays of crucial plays. For example, not to be too parochial, but the US clearly should have won 3-2 against Slovenia the other day when it drew 2-2. A goal was disallowed, and absolutely nobody can find a good reason for that decision. I think the referees are being protected. The other attitude FIFA has is that they shouldn't give press conferences and explain away their decisions. So we need more transparency, and yes, we do need some more technology.
Is there any talk of this, though, of having – I understand that they wouldn't want to slow the game down. And that's one of the paradoxically why I don't think it's broken through here in the United States, is because we have such a powerful television industry here, or control of television, and football, American football, is a perfect television sport because they stop every now and then so you can have commercials. So that's been one of the things I think that's held back soccer in this country. So how would you do this? You'd have to have somebody that could talk to the ref via his earphones, I mean, with a remote, who's watching, like a fourth or fifth ref, who watches it on television and says, wait a minute, before you blow your whistle, I think this is ambiguous, or this is how it should be.
You could do it that way with another official. The other way you could do it would be to allow each manager of each team, say, 3 or 4 appeals of decisions during a match. There would be a limit on this. This is what they do in cricket, which is the mother of baseball, right, in U.S. terms nowadays. Each side within a given inning has a number of appeals they can make. It'll slow the game down, but it won't happen very often. Your maximum would be, say, 6 times in 90 minutes. And on those 6 occasions, 3 for each team, the referee is obliged to go to an additional official who's in this eye in the sky, slightly removed, who makes a definitive decision. That would be a way where I think we would get fairer decisions, better decisions, but we wouldn't have a vexatious appellant system, right, such that forever the game was being interrupted just because managers wanted to pull back the flow of the opposing team.
Right. Well, I must say that the current situation, given how many critical games have been decided by officials, leads you to be, you know, wonder whether this is bias on the part of referees, whether it's incompetence, or whether there's some corruption. And I go back to the last World Cup where Australia played Italy to a draw almost to the end, and there was a really bad call that decided Australia's fate. Again, in the game that they just played yesterday, where against Ghana, there were the tying goal that Ghana got was entirely because of a penalty. And if you look at the replay on that, it's clear that the ball hit the guy in the shoulder. He was right in the goal. And the ball came at such velocity he couldn't have moved at any rate. It wasn't an intentional handball. And this guy's off for two games. And he's finished. And by the way, when you watch it on Univision in Spanish, you get some more angles. I don't know what's wrong with the feed that we get. And there was a much better angle that really showed that it hit him in the shoulder. So, you know, I mean, all that answers the question, doesn't it, that we have the technology to really see what happened.
Well, we do, absolutely.
What do you think?
I got to chime in here because my take on it is that's fine, and I think that the proposal has to be then that the refs have to let the ball, the play flow and not blow their whistles. Because once they blow the whistles, the team that has getting away with the bad decision will have an excuse. They'll say, well, we stopped playing once the whistle was blown. So if that stipulation is thrown in, it could be put forward like you're proposing, which is very close to American football where the coaches have appeals. But I think even simpler is what the Europa League is proposing right now, which are refs behind the goals. So at the most significant part of the field in front of the goal, they'd have somebody right behind the goal to make these kind of calls. But even then, the refs on the field then have to be disciplined to not quickly blow the whistle, let the plays flow and blow them after the fact. Because once a whistle blows, and this would be Slovenia's argument now if the goal had been allowed, because the Slovenians say, oh, well, we stopped, we heard the whistle. And if you hear the replay with the audio, he blows it in between when Donovan kicks it, and considerably before, given the flight of the ball, Adu hits it. So the Slovenians would have an argument. A pretty big argument.
No, I think that's right. But I think in terms of the Europa League notion of the additional referees at either end, a lot of people are still very unhappy about how well that would work, because there are some things those people would be well positioned to give an answer on and some they wouldn't. And that's why I think there is room for new technology. But your point about blowing the whistle is absolutely spot on. If I could just mention the corruption issue briefly, since you raised it, Ian. A lot of corruption in world sports comes from betting not on really big ticket items like who wins or whether there's a penalty or whatever. A lot of the corruption comes on absolutely minute, minuscule happenings. Huge money goes into something where it's very hard to trace whether or not there's corruption, because it's betting not on will the score be 3-0 or 4-2 or will Turkey win or will Harry Kuehl, the Australian guy, be sent off, but rather in the 14th minute, will the ball be played if it goes to the Australian goalkeeper or the Ghanaian goalkeeper to the right or the left? And that involves little, very easy people to corrupt. You just get a couple of players to say, I'll make sure I get the ball, I'll give it to you, you push it that way. vast amounts of money can be placed on very minimal activities that actually don't really influence the result. Mm-hmm. So that's one issue. The second issue is it's certainly true there have been major issues with corrupt officials in different parts of the world, big scandals in Germany over the last couple of years, Italy over the last couple of years. And then there is the question of quality. We've seen quite a lot of, if you like, first world prejudice or racism in the way that a number of referees from different countries have been described. In particular, it's often suggested, well, of course, we have these people from Africa who were there because this is decided in some sort of democratic way, rather like membership of the United Nations, and there's really not enough discrimination to ensure we have the best. Well, I'd remind people, particularly those who are British like me, that it's only in the last World Cup that Graham Pohl, considered one of the best referees in the world and a Brit, handed out two yellow cards to the same player against Australia again in the same game, who should have been therefore sent off with a red card, and forgot that he'd done so. So incompetence knows no country. And I've seen some, I think, superb refereeing from all over the world in many matches. The errors we've seen, I think, are not about corruption or about incompetence. They're bad decisions, but they're made because of pressure and the fact that too much is expected of one person. And there is, I still think, insufficient use of technology.
Right. But Toby Miller, when you talk about corruption in sports, and just to finish with the bad officiating, we had that hideous thing in baseball recently where the guy had a perfect game and the official later apologized, but again it indicates that there needs to be some kind of more authoritative way of when the audience knows what happens and the guy in the field doesn't, you know, you realize that there's a disconnect there. But I understand that just in terms of American football and basketball, the betting pool that goes on for every game is in the billions. There, you know, the sports betting goes on here. It's an unofficial. I mean, it's the informal bookies. And give me a sense of how that kind of float, that much money, by definition, has to affect things, doesn't it?
Well, I think there's no doubt that we run into all sorts of problems in the international sports world, not just in the US sports world, over betting. There's no question that there are players and officials right across the gamut of sports who are on the take. Mm-hmm. At the same time, international sports has tried to take this on with a whole series of inquiries, with sort of boardroom discussions, ex-police officers brought in to try to deal with it. But once you allow betting on sport at all, and once, in fact, you accept that sport is not just going to be about enjoyment and struggle and so on, but instead is going to be about how to make your college make a lot of money, or how to ensure that your team owner does well, not just from ticket sales, but from sales to television, you're changing the essence of the game. So the corruption isn't just about, I'll take money from you in return for throwing this match. Corruption is a much more complex and abstract concept that's to do with making sport into a capitalist endeavor, basically. Mm. And whilst there are all kinds of good aspects to that, there are some really negative, nasty ones as well. I mean, to take the example of timeouts, one of the reasons that there are so many timeouts in basketball is not just that coaches want them and players want them. It's that television wants them in order to place more and more commercials in place. That's not what the game needs. That's not what the game's about. And I find that an extremely troubling, negative aspect of much of a sport that we watch. Mm. Similarly, we've seen all this ambush marketing during the World Cup. It's alleged that a former British footballer, Robbie Earle, sold tickets that he'd been given as a commentator for ITV, a big British commercial network, to some marketers who wanted to do what's called ambush marketing, i.e. they're representing a brewer. The brewer has not actually done a deal with FIFA to be an official World Cup sponsor, but it wants to be able to take advantage of free television coverage by dressing people up in outfits that will ipso facto advertise their product. You have 30 or 40 pretty young women, conventionally pretty young women, let's say, dressed in these outfits with tickets sold by Robbie Earle, allegedly, mm-hmm. and they stand up and the brewer gets a free plug. So that's going on all the time. And again, that's because of the commodification. But I would say that whilst that is something you might regard as illegal, the very notion that extremely unhealthy food products and drinking products can sponsor what's meant to be an activity that's healthy in mind and healthy in body is itself absurd.
Remember, they used to there was that female cigarette that was sponsored a lot of women's tennis.
Virginia Slims.
Virginia Slims.
And that's it for our conversations today with Toby Miller, who is the chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. His most recent book is Television Studies, The Basics. But he has also written books called Globalization in Sport, as well as Sports Sex. And up next, we move on to an interview we did with Laurent Dubois right before the tournament began. It was a long interview, and we figured it's appropriate to play it now because he's the author of a brand new book called Soccer Empire, a book about the French national team in the context of French society and politics. And welcome to The People's Game, Pacifica Radio's show about the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament. I am your co-host, Alan Minsky. And I'm about to be joined by Laurent Dubois, a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University and author of the newly published book, Soccer Empire, The World Cup and the Future of France, and the founding editor of the Soccer Politics blog, which you can find at www.soccerpolitics.org. Professor Dubois taught a course in the fall of 2009 called, a very popular course, I must say, World Cup and World Politics. And Professor Dubois is also the author of a renowned work on the Haitian Revolution, Avengers of the New World. Welcome to Pacifica Radio's The People's Game, Professor Dubois. And I'm joined also by my co-host, Jennifer Doyle, blogger of the fantastic blog From a Left Wing. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Alan. I am going to just start off in saying you are a brave soul taking up this sport in the heart of basketball country. So you're kind of going against the flow at Duke University with this subject. So I wanted to begin our conversation with you by, of course, gesturing towards the obvious, the World Cup. But we thought that you would be a good person to talk to as a way to kind of address the conflicted feelings of the community, I think, that we represent here, where we're looking forward to the World Cup, excited about it because it's such an incredible spectacle and event, and it's a pleasure to get swept up in it. And yet, I don't know a single person who isn't also at the very same time deeply ambivalent about the nationalism that such an event generates and reproduces and amplifies. And in conversations about this kind of regressive element in the politics of the global game, people often gesture to France as either an exceptional team or as a team that's signaling a wave of a future in which very idea of nation and citizenship is under aggressive revision. So I was wondering if I could ask you to sort of talk a little bit about your work in relationship to these two pressures around soccer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's a tension that's always been there, in a sense, around the World Cup, which is at once a kind of, you know, universalizing tournament, you know, meant to be a kind of space of understanding and encounter. I mean, I think that was the ideals that drove its creation by Jules Rimet and others. But at the same time, of course, it obviously crystallizes nationalism in a certain kind of way, and I think it's so fascinating to see the interplay between those two. I mean, in my book, I explore the case of France, which I think in many ways is actually a fairly unique case. I think in some ways, I don't know if it can be applied to other places, and yet it is certainly a case where the fact that the national team has existed within the country and has existed in such an interesting and complicated way has actually enabled a certain kind of discussion to take place that actually is not really taking place to the same extent in other parts of French society.
Yeah.
So there's a weird correlation between the fact that precisely the nationalism and the kind of condensation of nationalism around the team actually allows for a kind of critique to come out of the team and surround it. So there's a play there that I think is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I know that with my own, I'm going to confess, I am a fan of Les Bleus. In the last World Cup, I remember reading in a local French newspaper's story, which really opened my eyes to the complexity of the relations between the team members. I mean, as is always the case with the French team, it seems in the past two decades, they start off in these kinds of tournaments in an uneasy place, which is very true right now, and In the last World Cup, the players spoke in an interview. It was actually Thuram in an interview said that the players were not connecting with each other until they found a common ground in their mutual sense of alienation from a traditional version of what a French national identity looks like.
Right.
And so it's in that kind of shared experience of an angled or critical relationship to a nationalist discourse about French identity that they ironically actually came together to represent the country of France.
Right. I think that's so true. And actually, I mean, I think that in 1998, for instance, the fact that Jean-Marie Le Pen attacked the team in 1996 during the European Cup, which was really his first foray into you know, an ongoing thing about attacking the team as not truly French, in many ways that was really crucial for the team, I think. Actually, it helped unite the team and it helped transform the team into a political symbol. I mean, after all, there's been a lot of players of, you know, of African descent or from North Africa or Africa on the French team really since its beginnings in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And yet the first time that really became a political symbol and a kind of anti-racist symbol was in 1996 and 98 because of that attack. And a lot of the players, I think, talk about that. Marcel Desailly and others in their autobiographies refer to that as well. There's even a way in which, I mean, I might say this in a way in the book, that for people like Thuram and Bernard Lama and others in that team, the team actually became a place where they kind of actually really addressed and started talking about issues of colonialism because they were put in this space where that was kind of, there was a light shined on that. And certainly, I mean, Thuram is a totally unique individual, but other players like Carimbeu and Thierry Henry in his way as well, I think have all been politicized in part in that way. So I do think that's really significant and important in the French team. I'll say in 2006, Thuram and others talk about, actually a lot of them say they kind of clicked when they went to Martinique, and you know they played, they never played in the Caribbean before, but they played this game in Martinique. And a lot of, you know, they sort of attributed to some extent their coming together to that being in that space, which I think is kind of interesting, especially since obviously many of the players were actually from the Caribbean themselves, and getting to play there was very important for them.
And we're speaking with Laurent Dubois, author of the new book, Soccer Empire, The World Cup and the Future of France. And I have to say it's a fantastically entertaining book, and a focus of the book and much of the narrative drama surrounds your analysis and critique of certainly the most memorable moment from the 2006 World Cup on the field, which was the red card at the end of the final that Zinedine Zidane got. And you really sort of look deeply into this moment. You provide a lot of background, and certainly Zidane is a very unique figure in French culture and, for what it's worth, also in Algerian French culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the book was really, I mean, the book exists, I guess, because of the headbutt. I mean, I say that, I mean, I was a French fan. I flew to Paris to be there during the final, and then, you know, experienced that, you know, there in part. I mean, I went because I wanted, whatever happened, I wanted to experience it in Paris and with, you know, surrounded by others experiencing the same thing. But it really began as an essay about that headbutt, and then as I delved more and more deeply into it, I just realized how many layers of signification were really packed into that moment.
Yeah.
In such a fascinating way.
And
so the book is kind of an attempt to, it starts with that and then it leads back to that and tries to give all the different, you know, moments that surround it. And it's also, in that sense, just a broader attempt just to suggest how moments like those, and there are other moments like them, I think, nothing exactly like that, but there are moments on the football field, especially in World Cup play, that just have a capacity to kind of crystallize and dynamize these bigger questions. And in the end, that's what I think keeps us coming back to them. You know, the nationalism is important, but in some ways, for so many people, you know, we watch the World Cup and we root for teams other than our own nations. I mean, it's almost necessary for most people in the world. But what keeps us coming back, I think, is the sense that this is just a space of interpretation that's just incredible and shared, you know, in a way that basically nothing else is in the world. So.
Yeah, and that incident was well and truly an incredible one for its... it was short, it was quick, it was definitive. He was ejected from the match, and yet no one exactly knows what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the kernel of it is this mystery as to, you know, what exactly did Materazzi say to him?
Right.
And what was Zidane thinking when he, in essence, sort of self-destructed in the last game of his professional career?
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful short, I guess it's a short story, is it... The Melancholy of Zidane is it by Jean-Philippe Toussaint.
Yeah, the Belgian writer, actually. Yeah.
Yes, in English, there's an English translation of it in New Formations, a journal,
mm-hmm.
And a special issue with other writing about that. And I was completely compelled by this man's description of trying to get inside the head of the moment, right, when somebody, in essence, walks away in the most dramatic way possible from an intense spectacle and all this expectation in terms of his nobility and performance. And then you have you write in your book actually about the interview that he gave a couple days later.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go to a bar des Sportifs in Clermont-Leroux in sort of like a small nothing town and to see that interview. And I was like, my jaw was on the floor because he was the machismo in his rhetoric defending that action was galling and completely seductive at the same time. You know, it was he was like been fighting in the French resistance. He had an army jacket on and it looked like it had been designed by Helmut Lang, but nevertheless it was, you know, thrown over his shoulders as if he'd just come in from out of the cold. And then he talks about, you know, how somebody insults his women and he can't but defend their honor, you know, and he doesn't even, you know, he said he didn't regret it because, you know, what else could he do as a man? And I was just like, there was very little pushing back, I thought, on that kind of deeply patriarchal structure of thought whereby the fragility of the women in your world become an excuse for this kind of aggression. I mean, whatever Matarazzi said, you know,
but there was also this line of commentary that I thought was really interesting afterwards, where it was kind of, you know, as people pointed out, had it been determined to have been a racist insult, it would have been considered much more serious than it just being a sexist insult.
Yeah.
In other words, and a bunch of people pointed that out, you know, like, well, what isn't it also extremely violent and offensive that, you know, to make a sort of sexual insult of some kind, or, you know, and whether his... And so that's kind of interesting, I think, too. And there's this kind of way in which, you know, and he keeps saying this. Even he said this recently. He sort of says, well, I, you know, it's not a good thing to do. But then he sort of says, well, I can't really apologize because to apologize would be to accept that Matarazzi was right to do what he did.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, you know, this great almost, you know, quixotic thing. It's like Zidane is basically saying people shouldn't, you know, in this incredible patriarchal and male space, people shouldn't, you know, do insults against our women. There shouldn't be this kind of realm of sexual insults, which is, it's so hard to imagine, you know, sports being purged of that.
I know.
Male sports being purged of that. And yes, there's this kind of almost amazing, you know, beauty to him trying to make that assertion. The other thing, of course, it's the same thing with the kind of racial politics,
yeah.
You know, that at once, I mean, what I found interesting is people could make the same point almost, you know, like, oh, he's an Algerian or he grew up in the banlieue, and it could be either a very racist thing, like it could be the right wing saying that, or it could be, you know, the president of Algeria or Kabyle activists or any number of other people saying it with this kind of sense of ethnic pride, you know, like he's really part of us and he showed that he was part of us. I mean, the same reference could mean so many different things. And, I mean, as I say in the book, it's just, you know, this is basically the... I mean, there had never been an incident in the history of the world that so many people watched and then commented on in a certain way. Obviously, 9/11 would be like the other kind of example in recent history.
So crazy.
But the fact that so many people watched it, but also so many people felt like they had something to say about it. It was like that. What I think is fascinating about it too, you know, that everyone had an opinion, or not everyone, but a lot of people had opinions about it, and still do. You know, when I give talks about this at universities, inevitably I'll get into very, you know, much more heated conversations than I ever do about the Haitian Revolution or something, about Zidane's headbutt. Because people have very strong feelings about it, you know.
Yeah, and in the book, you handle it marvelously because you keep coming at the event from different angles, different approaches, always sort of unveiling new levels of meaning. So Laurent Dubois' brand new book is Soccer Empire, The World Cup and the Future of France. Fantastic book. I really recommend people pick it up. And again, France does have this strange recent history within the tournament. We'll talk about the particularities of this year's French national team in a few minutes. But in 2002, they were as flat as they were brilliant in 1998 and 2006. So It's quite a question mark what 2010 will hold for the team, but
they're really great at lowering everyone's expectations of them and then defying all logic.
Yeah. It's been like that way for the whole 20th century. You know, it's just amazing. It's this kind of anyway.
C'est très français.
Well, but when they've been good in recent years, going all the way back to the 80s, they've played fantastically beautiful football.
Right.
But you also have another article out. And again, as I said when I introduced you, you're also the author of the book Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. And you have a book out, an essay out right now. I picked it up from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette called America's Haitian Hero. He scored the winning goal in one of the greatest upsets in sports history, referring to the 1950 USA defeat of England. Will there be another one this week? And what you're referring to is the assumed to be the starting striker for Team USA is Josie Altidore, who is of Haitian descent. So what took place in 1950 could be replicated at the World Cup on Saturday, 2010.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, of course, it would be too good to be true if it happened, but, you know, that's okay, I suppose. I called attention to that, and there's actually a really great essay done by Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated a few months ago about Joe Gatchens, and he had gone, really gotten in touch with the family and uncovered some really interesting things about his life. But it's just, this is another place where, I mean, Haitians, except for 1974, haven't been in the World Cup, but here is this kind of great Haitian footballer who played a really important role in the history of U.S. sport, but is kind of not so well known. And so for me, it's a way of connecting my two interests. In that 1950 World Cup, he was recruited onto the U.S. team, along with several other people who weren't actually U.S. nationals. They allowed them on the team with the kind of promise that they would ask for U.S. citizenship. And he ends up scoring the winning goal in this upset against England. I mean, that was a much more kind of David and Goliath than even the U.S.-England match this week will be. And yet there's this kind of striking parallel in the sense that in an interesting way, these two Haitian or Haitian American, in the case of Altidore, players may end up, you know, play this crucial role in the U.S. And it's just, for me, a symbol of the broader way in which, you know, football kind of can condense nationalism, but there's also all these interesting ways in which it can always undermine it as well at the same time. And it can play both those roles a little bit and remind us of the interconnectedness as well as of national.
I mean, and his story is it's both a very interesting one and a very sad one.
Right.
Right.
I mean, I came across him reading the Game of Their Lives,
mm-hmm. Right.
And which is a book which is just, you know, about this this amazing upset of England, and which the author interviews family members of the people who had played in those matches and the like. But in some of the ways in which that story gets framed, it gets framed as these, you know, a kind of a ragamuffin crew of dishwashers, who were not U.S. citizens and were sort of thrown into this impossible situation and then came away with this amazing victory. But in that is obscured of the player that you're writing about. I believe he was a student at Columbia. And he may have been washing dishes, but I think that was partly to support himself in school. And he went back to Haiti after all of this, and was murdered, and so it's just there's a complex story around his life that, you know, as somebody who's always already a kind of marginal figure in U.S. sports history, partly because of the place of soccer in U.S. sports history, but then, you know, the double whammy of being a non-national player. Playing in that kind of underdog sport in 1950, you know, we just lose these really kind of dense and these stories which actually, though, reveal a lot about the texture of American culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was really interesting, and it's true that the story is really sad. I mean, he actually, fell prey to the Duvalier dictatorship. He wasn't himself in politics, but mm-hmm. Some of his family members were, and he actually didn't leave. He didn't leave when several of them left. Thinking he was sort of safe since he wasn't involved in politics, and then was basically kind of punished for his family's activism.
Yeah.
I mean, he died at Fort Dimanche, which is this, you know, legendary kind of prison under the Duvalier dictatorship. So that's another part of the erasure. I mention on the blog I've got a student who's in Haiti right now, and she's been writing some dispatches about just, you know, the Haitian relationship to the World Cup, and it's such a fascinating, in particular this year, of course, a particularly potent and fascinating and important thing. But I think it's just another example, I think, of how there can be these kind of surprises on the field. So for me, there's also, you know, there's a way in which, I mean, when in the quote I gave to the Sports Illustrated article was that Gaetjens is just sort of actually an example among many of what the U.S. owes to Haiti.
Yeah.
So it's part of that like larger point that we usually think of it of the other way around, but there's all these ways in which Haiti has shaped U.S. history that, that don't go acknowledged.
The question of the 1950 game and the game coming up, USA versus England, I noticed that you had in the World Cup and World Politics course that you taught at Duke, you had a class about the curious case of the United States. And, of course, this is something that's generally new to America. I have been impressed with the amount of coverage that the World Cup has had. Every time I open up my computer, it goes to yahoo.com. The amount of soccer stories in the past few weeks has been, to my mind, much larger than previous World Cups. But just the centrality of soccer in American sports culture is so much less than it is almost everywhere else around the world. And I just want to sort of talk about the course you taught at Duke and just maybe actually some just how was it received by the students? How was it received by the university? How popular was it? And if you want to, in advance of Saturday's match, say what you learned from the course about soccer in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fun part of the course. The course was, it was quite popular. It was the first time it was offered, and we got a lot of students. And I linked it up, actually, to a series of events. So we had a lot of visitors, including Turam, who came to campus, and that was great. And we had a film series as well.
I'm so jealous.
I want to go to Duke.
So, I mean, that was pretty much the highlight of my life, and I think a lot of the students as well. Which, it kind of was a capstone to it. We also did a lot of, bringing in sort of the coach of the men's team, John Kerr, as well as Carla Overbeck, who came in to talk about the Women's World Cup in 1999 and so forth. So actually, when we talked about U.S. sport, a lot of it was about gender and the kind of interesting way in which, soccer in the U.S. has played this incredibly important role in terms of women's sports. And people kind of thought about where that might go and where that might lead as well. So those were really, really interesting discussions. I mean, I didn't, in a sense, I partly wanted to decenter the U.S. in a way. I mean, we, of course, didn't get to the U.S. until later. And we also discussed Paul Quadros' book, which is about, a team here in North Carolina that he created at a high school. It's a book you're probably familiar with as well. Called A Home on the Field. So all those issues about immigration and the class issues and the gender issues in U.S. soccer, I think, are really interesting.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about your work, I find, is that through my own engagements with French contemporary culture, there's certain issues around French national identity and French cultural identity, especially among younger people, where that push people to look to African American and Latino communities within the United States.
Right.
I remember when I believe it was the year that the last World Cup, Quinceañera was a film which is actually set in Echo Park, Los Angeles, mm-hmm. was released in France, and it was actually it was released in France as Echo Park, and and it was accompanied by stories about the other Americans.
Right.
And so it was this interesting moment of discovery within contemporary French sort of popular culture of Latinos and Chicanos in particular in on the West Coast and, in Southern California, and an identification with a lot of the struggles of particularly immigrant communities within Southern California, because a lot of the issues that people are having to wrangle with on a day-to-day basis are very similar.
Yeah, no, I think it's really crucial. It's interesting in part because I think, some of the debates in the United States, as well as hip-hop culture and those sorts of things, provide a language that is otherwise somewhat lacking in France. So, I mean, one of the most crucial things is that it provides a language for talking about the police, and the kind of parallels there. At the same time, of course, the situations are different. And I think in particular, the interest in Latinos, there's an interesting parallel in terms of the way in which religious differences and the way in which a kind of, if you think of France and Algeria and the U.S. and Mexico as these places with these very tight connections, and a very complicated history, and then the way in which immigration shapes out. Obviously, they're not the same, and yet the parallels, I think, really interest people.
Yeah, and then I see this kind of interesting kind of loop around soccer, insofar as, in Southern California, playing on playing pickup games with guys, in downtown Los Angeles, And folks are wearing the shirts of immigrant players, right, in playing in Europe, players of African and Caribbean descent, and actually doing this kind of cross-identification, right, back across the ocean, across the Atlantic.
Right.
It's an I think it's a very complex dialogue and conversation that is happening around this of these iconic figures like Tiram.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think people, there's a strong sense that they think of them as kind of these outsiders in a certain way, and everybody, so people who have an experience of feeling outside can relate to that. I think globally that is one of the things that's why you do find a lot of fans of the French team, not because they think France is the greatest country in the world,
yeah.
but maybe for the opposite reason, but that,
exactly.
that they think that the team is just this really interesting, obviously a lot of professional teams are kind of like that, but they don't have the same political reach, whereas something about this European team that's not really a European team or that is so much about the symbol of the history of all these exchanges, and of all those changes coming home to roost in a certain way.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't hurt that people like Zidane and Thuram have just been so compelling, as figures. I mean, so complex and interesting. And really, I don't think there's anyone in the world, no athlete who we could admire quite as much as Thuram for his political stance. It's just a very unique figure to have been able to use the fact of being a national figure and a national hero to really make, to make political points and intervene.
Yeah, the guy quotes Fanon in interviews.
I'm sorry?
The guy quotes Frantz Fanon in interviews.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk to Thuram, it's kind of, we had, these dinners here when he was here where it was like Thuram and, the African-American studies faculty at Duke, which is a pretty august group of people. And they were just kind of blown away. He would just ask all, I was asking all these questions, this incredible curiosity, and this is somebody who basically, finished high school in a French, soccer academy kind of program. It's just kind of incredible. And he's able to address things, and he's able to connect his own experience to these larger structural issues in a way that's really kind of remarkable. And to speak to these issues, in a way that's just really compelling, I think, to people who are listening to him, both younger people and older people.
And he has a book coming out, right?
He has a book that's already come out, which is called Mes Étoiles Noires, which has sold a lot of copies in France, and it's essentially black people in black history, sort of figures from, Lucy to Obama is the subtitle. So it goes back through the history of Africa and up to the present day, and kind of just meant to give people an idea of different
figures. That is a long arc of history.
Exactly.
And Jennifer, are you fluent in French? Do you?
I am, yes.
So it sounds like we're going to have to get a copy of this and ask for the interview from that author in the course of this show. And also, Thuram, at his most celebrated moment, right, in the history of his soccer career, his second goal against Croatia, which propelled France into the 1998 World Cup final, he had really one of the most incredible celebrations I've ever seen, certainly one of my favorite. Do you remember? He got down on his knees and he put his hand to his mouth in a gesture of, let me think about what
right.
just happened. Yeah.
yeah.
We're going to think right
thinker,
now.
The thinker on the field. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And, those are the two only goals that Thuram ever scored
yeah.
for France.
Right. He's a defender.
And he
for
played,
those who don't know. Oh.
He played more games than any other French player had ever played before. He played 142 and he only scored two goals. And those were the ones,
Yeah, he just took it on in the second half. He
yeah,
said, "I'm going to do this."
It was like, and he kind of, it's just sort of like he decided that it was sort of up to him.
That is the mindset of a good defender. If you kind of have this attitude, if nobody else is going to do it, then
right.
it's up to me, right?
right?
And that includes
and
scoring.
And also,
yeah.
he was angry because he had messed up, on the
yeah.
play
the first,
that
on the goal, right?
That scored on,
right?
Yeah,
that's
and
true.
So yeah, so there's a, but there's, it's just, I mean, there are moments like that, in soccer where you just. There's, it's this kind of almost spiritual thing, that I think, and that's what I think really kind of draws people to it. And even in the last final game, when Zidane went to his academy as a kid, he had a real problem, which is that he didn't like to head the ball. The coaches,
right.
he basically
right.
never, he just said, well, we played in Castellan when you didn't do headers, they just weren't considered interesting, and we played with our feet, and so they kind of said, well, you should work on your headers a little bit. And so luckily he did. Because both of those were goals that he scored in a way that, was actually his weakest spot in some ways. So.
Actually, I want to shift back to the course, just the headline of the course, World Cup and World Politics. I think more than a tournament in Germany, more even than a tournament in East Asia, the 2002 tournament, to have the tournament in Africa is to ask, it does sort of bring to mind questions about global politics. To have it in South Africa, a country that dominated the minds of people who were political around the world for decades in the latter third of the 20th century, begs the question of politics, the state of society, the state of the world. So what were the general insights that you bring to the 2010 World Cup from your course, World Cup and World Politics? We're in a global financial crisis. The tournament's in South Africa. Soccer seems to make more money than ever. What were the primary observations about those general themes?
Well, part of it was just looking at the kind of long history of football in Africa from colonial times to the kind of struggles of the Confederation of African Football to get, you know, more respect and more footing in FIFA, the whole history of the very, you know, the boycott of South Africa by CAF and by FIFA, which was, in one of the more intense politicizations of football. So all that was to give the students just a sense of the depth of history that's kind of coming to bear on this particular World Cup, as well as just the inside, you know, the transformations of FIFA as well in the 70s and 80s and the role that Africa played in that kind of shift as well. So, I mean, what was interesting in the course is that in some ways, if you wanted to, you know, talk about world history, this is just a great way to do it. So they were able to just learn about the dynamics of decolonization through this particular case of, you know, kind of decolonizing or trying to decolonize FIFA itself, in which, you know, it crystallizes so many of these broader issues. Mm. So in some ways, we thought of 2010 as a kind of culmination of a fairly long struggle, decades-long struggle regarding the place of Africa in world football, as well as something that highlighted, you know, the continuing ironies that the football economy is still European-centered, you know, that the money still is, and so that there's a kind of sense in which all these sorts of things come together as both the possibilities and the hope and the kind of going ironies and legacies of colonialism are.
Well, it's often invoked in newspaper stories, especially within Europe, of the ways in which the recruiting of young players from Africa replicates a ghosted version of the slave trade.
Absolutely, and people even refer to it, I mean, in the same way that sometimes this metaphor comes up in the United States, but there are some writers who've literally called it a kind of new slave trade. And
I think the United Nations in 1999 did, a United Nations commission, mm-hmm. worried about a new slave trade in African football players.
For people who are not familiar with the issues that arise here is that very young players get recruited from African countries and then brought into European countries are left with no passport, no money, and basically just sort of abandoned on the streets of various cities. And so this is becoming a growing and growing problem as people are trying to make a profit off of the development of soccer players, because one of the unique aspects of soccer outside the United States, when you develop a soccer player, you in essence have an investment in that player as that player gets traded. And so people, there is an economic incentive actually in the deep exploitation of numbers of boys.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, we were lucky to have at a conference here, Peter Alleggi and Paul Darby, who both written really wonderful books about FIFA and Africa. And Alleggi has a new book out called African Soccerscape that traces the history of football in Africa and South Africa.
And you can find the interview with Peter Alleggi that we did on the peoplesgame.org, the website for the show.
Okay,
and they
have
marvelously insightful about the history of soccer in Africa. And so returning back then to the game on the field, and I suppose really two questions. One is the tournament on the field in general. Who do you like? And secondly, or first, and then to that second, your breakdown of the current French side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, the French side is really interesting. In some ways, there's a continuity with 2006, in that there's still this core of Caribbean players and some new players who weren't there. I mean, and that's one of the things I emphasize in the book, that basically 9 of the 23 players were either born in or had roots in Guadeloupe, Martinique, and French Guiana. And a lot of those players, Malouda, Galas, Abidal, mm-hmm. Henri, are still there, and then Gaël Clichy and Anelka also Martinican background are there. So there's that interesting side. Then there's, of course, a number of players who are the children of African immigrants to France, Sanya, Evra, and several others. And then, interestingly, there's actually no North African players on the team. So Benzema and Nesri, who were hopefuls, are not there. And so that's a kind of intriguing thing. Is sort of in fact, there weren't ever that many of those players in recent history. I mean, Zidane was a kind of unique one, but of course a very important one. And in a way, you know, it's this team. I think in some ways there's it's a continuity that we've seen before. It's a team of incredibly talented players that has not gelled. You know, and obviously the coach is beleaguered and maybe justifiably so. You know, sort of just seen as a big problem. At the same time, and Zidane just said this in an interview I saw recently, and Thuram emphasized this when he was here, you know, people asked him about the coach, and he said, you know, honestly, when you're this kind of, you know, when you're at our level of play and you go to the World Cup, you don't really play for the coach anymore. You know, the question is the team going to be able to figure it out on the field and create a kind of dynamic? If they can, they've obviously got the talent to do very well. If they don't, you know, they could just drop out almost in the first round, you know, which is what happened in 2002. So, it's really possible for it to go either way, and the question is, you know, is there going to be kind of leadership on the field, and who's going to take it? I mean, obviously Henri is a good candidate, Ribéry, Evra perhaps. So if they can, and you know, I remember watching in 2006, you could really see the team coalesce in the group stages of 2006. The team really didn't do very well,
right.
And I remember you just watch these little conferences that were like Makalele, Zidane, and Thuram. I've got a picture of one of these in early in the book. They were talking on the field, and they had to figure it out, and they kind of then sort of directed some of the younger players, and so I mean, these are obviously really incredible professionals, and they've got a lot of experience among them, so we'll see. You know, I mean, I'm going to root for France because I've got to, and you kind of stay loyal in some ways, and I do still, you know, have some hope for the team, although obviously I'm going to be torn when they play South Africa, because I think I also really would love to see South Africa progress and do well.
Yeah, it's a tricky group. In fact, all four sides in that group, there's reason for me, and I, unlike Jennifer and yourself, I'm not a partisan of the French side traditionally, but all four teams really merit affection from my point of view. Of course, Mexico is far and away the most popular side in the region where Jennifer and I are at in Southern California. Uruguay, of course, is a very small country that sees itself as having sort of invented modern soccer in some respects. And then South Africa,
yeah,
is the host country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, France, certainly there's very mature players that make up the side. I do expect the play to run through Ribéry. Are you expecting that?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, I think he's really crucial. That could be really crucial. And I think if he can hold up, I mean, the Anelka is, you know, very varied, you know, in his play. But when he's at his best, he's just totally brilliant. And
sure.
But then there's these players. I mean, Sanya is such a core of that team and just so cool and collected and calm and just sort of unflappable, and that's pretty important. So there's, I think all those kinds of players will play different kinds of roles.
And Malouda at certain points was just on fire for Chelsea at certain points this year. So that, you know, again, within the group, I do think France has the most individual talent, certainly. And I suppose I'm expecting them to pass through the group. But we'll see. It's a tricky group. Any group with a host country is always very tricky. And then just, I suppose, pulling back the lens for an even broader view, your take on the tournament, any sides that you see as standing out, and dare I ask, who do you think might take the tournament?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so exciting about it is I'm actually really not sure. I mean, it seems like so many of the traditional strong sides may be weak this time, which is, I think, in a way, good news, and I'm hoping that, like the Asia tournament, you know, maybe the different setting and the case of it being in South Africa will change the dynamics to somewhat. I mean, like everyone, obviously, I'd love to see the African teams do well, and I think several have a chance of doing so, despite the fact that there's these, you know, now suddenly beleaguered Ivory Coast team, and so you know, that's gonna be really important to watch, and I would just love to see some of those teams get to the round of 16 and maybe further. I'm also, you know, despite everything, I think Argentina, I think, is going to be a team to watch. Another one of these teams that, if they can pull it together, could be just amazing. And I think we'll play really exciting soccer. So I hope that'll be
I can't
crucial.
Wait.
I can't either.
Sorry?
I can't wait to do this, to watch these games. You know, here the opening match, Plaza de Mexico
in
Linwood is going to have a public screening.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you're about LACMA is, and all the Brits are flocking to the screening at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art for the USA England match. It's really going to be a lot of fun.
And, you know, we're showing actually at the Hammer Museum at the Billy Wilder Theater on June 6th the Douglas Gordon and Philippe Perrineau Zidane film.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah, we're doing a screening of that here, too, actually.
Yeah, that's the first screening in the region. And that's 17 cameras trained on this iconic figure of Zidane while he played a match for Real Madrid. I believe that match was actually played in 2005. The film is available in every supermarket in France.
Right.
I'm going to say
in the United States.
It's a non-narrative experimental
right.
film.
It's an amazing film. In fact, it is probably you've probably seen. I'm sure you've seen it. We screened it here at Duke last fall with the 35mm and everything, and it was great. And but it is the most polarizing film, literally, that I know of. You know, in other words, there are some people. There are a lot of people who find it absolutely sublime and enrapturing, and there's a number of other people who find it completely insufferable. And so it's interesting. It's partly, if you think, you know, if you try to combine, you know, performance art and art film with soccer, a lot of people are not going to be happy with
perverse,
the outcome one way
or the
other.
I have a perverse take on this, which is that it's a multi-million dollar version of what thousands of soccer fans do every day, which is the YouTube homage to their favorite player, scored to their favorite pop song, because this film is actually scored to Mogwai, and it's just a worshiping at the feet of the heroic figure of Zidane while listening to awesome music and for the duration of a soccer match.
But also, like, weirdly deconstructing a soccer game. And I think the thing that with my students, we showed it early on in the semester, and actually one way, if you ever want to, like, sort of test your students, if you show that movie in the first week and then say, do you really want to take this class? Because we're about to watch 90 minutes of Zidane, like, walking around. Because basically, he doesn't have the ball very much.
Yeah.
And he's at work. I mean, I think that's what some of the thing, the insight that the students got was, I was like, oh, this guy's just, he's at his job, you know? This is his job. He's working. And so there's a way in which that is kind of really interesting. But it's a great film. And I think, and the film that we also screened, which I highly recommend, is the Maradona sort of, epic by Costa Rica, which is another kind of over-the-top film, completely different. So those, I mean, there's such great culture that's being produced around the sport in so many different venues, and it's exciting to see.
It's just funny you mentioned Maradona at the end there, because we spoke about Zidane, two men who really sort of have this habit of being the center of the universe, and there's going to be a lot of focus on Maradona. Now, this is wrapping up, and we've made this entire interview available for those listening right now through the podcasts on our website and through the KPFK website, our host station. And if those of you, like, sort of hate academic theoretical discourse, you're going to want to turn this off right now and flee. But didn't, like, Walter Benjamin have this, and maybe you guys both aren't up on this, didn't he have this idea in Kafka about a literature of gesture?
Yeah.
Did you guys read that
at
all?
I'm having, like, a throwback to my undergraduate years.
That's
one of the ways I look at the Zidane episode.
It sort of
fits within this. I mean, here's this, he's going to do this one thing, but the absolute other side of interpretation, and I sadly have to admit, because it's something you almost have to be ashamed of, is I'm an Italian fan, you know, winning ugly and stuff in recent times when they're winning. But, you know, I also just viewed it as the guy was damn frustrated that he couldn't score on him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're going back to the headbutt.
Yeah, going back to the headbutt.
No, obviously. I mean, I think that's the key. Is it's at once, like, the most banal and kind of non-interesting thing.
What
FIFA actually, one of the guys at FIFA said, this is d'une banalité affligeante, you know, like a painfully banal incident.
Yeah.
He said, we have 10,000 of these a year.
Yeah.
And yet it wasn't, you know, and yet it was this kind of unbelievable event that took on all these meanings.
There were two,
not because of Zidane, but because of the world.
I watched it actually in a village in France, and at halftime, everyone turned away from the television and pretty much stopped watching the match. They were like, oh, it's over. Basically, the Italians are going to play their game. No one is going to score. It's going to go to penalties, and they have Buffon, and we have Barthez. It's c'est fini.
Right. Yeah,
and so they barely even noticed the headbutt. You know, the people I was watching with it, they were like, oh, yeah, well, they just saw it actually as he may as well go out on that, because better that than this rather undramatic, totally predictable loss to the ugly game.
Played just perfectly correctly and then losing anyway to penalty.
And a fact almost never brought up is Materazzi was the other goal scorer in the game.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, this, you know, you know, wormy, nasty guy who just happens to be really tall and get on headers and pound the ball in the back of the net off set pieces.
Right.
You know? And he had equaled the great Zidane.
The beautiful game. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's such an interesting and, you know, but the, I think this is one of the things we talked about a lot in our class, which is that, you know, what I think actually, I mean, people complain about this, but it's the unfairness of soccer is one of the things that ultimately mm-hmm. makes it so great or so important.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that the kind of infuriating way in which things just do not turn out the way that, you know, you might want them to. I mean, a lot of sports are like that, but soccer,
this.
I think, more than any. And there's a way in which that's part of, you know, what's so infuriating about it and what keeps us coming back to it, because it also drives the sense that, like, maybe next time, you know, it's going to actually go the way it should.
Well, I think people feel so cheated in, you know, in so many different ways in their everyday lives. And sports gives you a domain in which you can express that. That sense of being cheated and feel kind of feel like you can say that, and it's legitimate and even a heroic form of complaint, whereas saying, you know, I'm not getting the raise that I should, or, you know, why is it so hard for me to find a job, and I just lost my house and it was stolen basically by the bank. Like, you know, it's hard to express that sense of actually life cheating you, right? And life depriving you of the things that you well and truly deserve, right? And sports seems to actually provide this kind of theatrical space where people can kind of work that through in very dramatic ways.
Yeah, and they can at least identify the source to some extent. You know, whereas in our own lives, we really can't. You know, what's the reason why? You know,
I'm going to say this is actually
that is happening. Whereas there's sort of some extent there's a moment, you know, where you can see it happening.
And there's this is a great sort of subject for our sort of last act of our conversation. As one might say, this is how France wound up in the World Cup. In the first place, is with the cheating gesture of Henri's handball right in front of the goal.
But again, actually, you know, one of the, you know, Roy Keane, did you see his response to that?
Yeah.
The great Irish player? I mean, you know, again, just that ball should never have dropped in the middle area. The Irish deserved it, you know?
Right.
I mean,
there's
so much. My thing, too, on what we were just talking about is that, of course, the sport is structured to have very few runaways.
Right.
I mean, the percentage of games that are decided by one goal either way is exceptionally high. And so the thing is incredibly dramatic.
It's the most unstable. It's sort of, you know, it's the most unstable game in the sense of the game that spends the longest time in ties of any game, you know. And that's, I think, important. Mm. But,
Well, Laurent Dubois, it's been fantastic speaking with you. I believe you are off to watch the tournament on foreign shores, is that correct?
Yes, I'm going to be heading to South Africa, not immediately, but in a couple of weeks. So I'll be there for the last 2 weeks or so.
And I believe we'll be trying to get in touch with you then and speak to you again at that point.
That would be great. Yeah, and I'll be blogging on the blog about, you know, my sort of vision of things, and would be happy to talk more, of course.
At soccerpolitics.com.
That's right. Yeah,
great. Right,
and I think I gave that dot org earlier. Correct, at soccerpolitics.com.
I think they'll both work. So, but anyway, it's easy to find. Just soccerpolitics. It's pretty easy.
And Laurent Dubois is the author of the brand new book, fantastic book, Soccer Empire: The World Cup and the Future of France. Thank you for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thank you.